Brethren, if you would turn to Isaiah 55. Isaiah 55. God reveals many things about himself in the pages of Scripture. And there's something, it's a little fundamental, but it's important here at the beginning. I want to establish it in Isaiah chapter 55. We'll start in verse 8. Isaiah 55 and verse 8. He says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are my ways your ways, or nor are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Verse 10, "For as the rain comes down, the snow from heaven, do not return there, but water the earth, and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes forth from my mouth. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it." Now, I mentioned this for a very general sort of principle here at the beginning, and that is to establish that God is very intentional. God has purposes and plans. He doesn't just act. He doesn't just speak carelessly or make decisions carelessly. He acts with intention. He acts with purpose. He designs with purpose. Sometimes that purpose is inherently functional. Sometimes it's beautiful. But regardless, he's not haphazard. When the words go forth from his mouth, they accomplish something. They don't return to him void. God is not a God of idle words. He acts. He acts with intention. He has ends and he's committed to achieving them. And so with that in mind, kind of moving away by one abstraction and getting a little more concrete, if we go to James chapter 1. James 1 says something subtle, but it's an important fact about our own existence. James chapter 1. And we read here in James 1, we'll start in verse 17. James 1 and verse 17. James promises all of us, starting in verse 17, "Every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning." If there's something that is truly of eternal benefit, we're guaranteed that comes from God. It's from his design. It's from his purpose that he intends it. Verse 18, "Of his own will he brought us forth by the word of truth, that we might be a kind of first fruits of his creatures." It's important to recognize that our existence in the church, but I would go so far as to say our existence on earth, our existence as human beings, is because God wills it to be so. He has a desire that it be so. God didn't make us out of obligation. He made us out of desire. He has a plan. He has a purpose. He has something he wants to accomplish. Of his own will, he brought us forth. You know, God isn't some kind of weird Star Trek God, a fake God. I remember, and I could be misremembering it. Those of you who are old enough to remember the original Star Trek, so you can correct me later. But I remember one where there was like some alien being who acts like the god Apollo, and he's making them do all of his will, and then somehow I could be mixing this up with something completely different, but they start to realize, well, that he only has power because we believe in him, or because we're relenting and yielding. And the moment they stop, he's like, "No, you have to believe in me," and he just starts melting away, and just, you know, and his power diminishes. God isn't like that. God would be God whether we were here or not. He is eternal. He's not dependent on us for anything. Which means he didn't make us because he needed to, because he had to, because he loves and because he wants to. We exist because he wants us to. And therefore, there must be purpose and design in our existence, and there is. We don't exist haphazardly, we're not randomly, we're not at the mercy of anything but his desire and his plans. And so the good facets of human existence, those things that are there because they are beneficial to us, because they help us along in everything that God is trying to do with us, were designed by him for his purposes. He made us for purpose, And so the things that in our lives that help achieve that purpose are also there by His design. And that includes, in particular, our focus for today, the human family. Human family is not some artifact of random evolution that, well, this just seemed to help with survival, and therefore that's exactly what happened. It's not that. It's also not because humans just get together and decide, what shall we do? Oh, let us make a family and let us do this. Family exists, as we see from even the beginning, by God's own design. God designed the human family for purpose and for cause. And it's important for us to understand what that cause is and what those purposes are. When you have a tool of any sort, it's important to know what is its purpose. What is it here to accomplish? Lest you misuse the tool and maybe get some benefit out of it, but not every benefit that you should be getting out of it. You want to know what it's there for so you can act in accordance with its use. So you can use it in the best manner, the manner for which it is designed. And so today I want to focus on the purposes of family. If God designed the family, what are His purposes for it? What did He design it to achieve? What is He trying to accomplish in humanity with the family? So that's my topic today, and the title of the sermon today is The Divine Purposes of Family. The Divine Purposes of Family. Now, as we launch into this, I need to say a number of things up front to help sort of set the stage. Because I don't know about all of you, and I don't know your details, but I definitely know about myself. And I didn't come from a perfect family background. I just didn't. My children, on the other hand, absolutely have. Everything about their has been absolutely perfect. Okay, I know that's not the case either. We come from different kinds of backgrounds. And it's important to recognize that God doesn't require the ideal in these things to exist in our lives for His purposes to be achieved. So some of us have grown up in broken homes where the mother and father we grew up with aren't the mother and father that conceived us, so to speak. Maybe both of those parents were long gone, for instance. I know a number of people that grew up in homes that were for the sake of helping children whose parents either couldn't afford them or circumstances like that. We have people that long to have children and haven't been able to have children and don't anticipate having children for the rest of their lives. And that's short of and different than this fuller design of the family. But does that mean somehow that, well, we're cut off in some way and that the purposes that God has can't be fulfilled with us? There are some that would like to be married and aren't and are starting to think, well, you know, am I one of those who won't be, you know, in this life? You know, there's a lot of encouragements in the Bible. When you look at the Christians in the Bible, when you look at the people of God, actually from both Old and New Testaments, you see a variety of people. You see people that come from broken families, sons of prostitutes. You have individuals that never married in their life, or individuals that, if they were married, they certainly didn't seem to have any children. Or those who did have children, their children turned out to be absolute heathens, you know, and departing and achieving no good with them. You see a ton of different circumstances in the Bible. God does not require the ideal, quote unquote, the abstract way, you know, everything He created in this life to be exactly there for Him to achieve His purposes. And so I need to say that because I'm going to be talking about the overall design. I'm going to be talking about the way God designed things to work. But it's important to recognize I'm not talking about, therefore, if somehow something in our life departs from the ideal, well, therefore, there's just some aspect of eternity that I'm not going to be able to enjoy. I guarantee you that's not the case. That's not the case. Family is one of God's tools. It is a beautifully designed tool. But if we're not willing to talk about the way it was designed to function in its completeness, well, then we end up falling short in knowing what things do we need to make up for. The world tends to have so much sympathy for those who don't have the fullness of a family the way it was designed to be that they end up catering to the others so much that they've just lost the meaning of what a family even is. To the point where they say, well, you know, you don't really have to have both parents. It's not, well, no, it's true. You can be raised in a single parent home. I, in many ways, virtually was, in a lot of ways, not some of the ways I could have been. But it's important for me to know that actually it's better to have both parents in the home, because then I know what things I might need to make up for. It's important to know, for instance, that when you're married, having a spouse tends to smooth off some rough edges in your life. We'll say some things about that, but let's just say I'm a different person than I would have been if I hadn't married. And when I think about me not married, I shudder a bit and I kind of move on, you know, to other thoughts. But that's important. Therefore, I had to know, okay, if I'm a single person, then I realize I don't have that in my life. So what rough edges are there? We have to understand that there are step families that have to recognize, well, you know, this husband or this wife is not the biological father or mother of the children. Studies show that brings in differences. If we don't talk about them, then we don't know what to adapt for. We don't know what we need to deal with to try to make it better. We don't know what things people can start off with that are helpful that we might need to take the extra steps to make a difference for. But as we move on to these things, the last thing I'll say is to highlight that everything in this life, in this physical life that we have now, there is nothing in this physical life that is meant to be eternal that we will somehow miss out on. Well, how do I put it? I want to get it really carefully. Let me say this. Let me put it this way. All the things we have here are meant to picture a broader eternal reality. And this isn't what it's all about. This is meant to picture those things. And we'll talk about these things here. For instance, as just to kind of jump ahead, but Ephesians 5 talks about how we learn about Jesus Christ and his bride through marriage. But if we're not married in this life, and let's say somehow we die and have never married, somehow will we be in eternity think, I don't even know what I'm doing for eternity. It's been 18 billion years and I just don't know how to be the bride of Christ. I can't even enjoy being the bride of Christ. That's not going to be the case. It's simply not. God has other ways of teaching the things we need. There's nothing we need for eternity that God will somehow say, I can't believe I can't teach my son or daughter this because they don't have this. You know what I haven't been challenged with yet? The difficulties of dealing with vast wealth. You know, when God gives me all of creation and I'm there with everything God has made, it's like, well, God, you never gave me the opportunity in this life because I never had vast wealth. That's on you, God. That's on you. Is that how that works? That's not how that works. All of us have different circumstances, and God will ensure that every joy he intends for us in eternity, we will have the opportunity in this life to develop and grow to be ready for. So please keep that in mind. There's no reason to think, like if we're childless, no reason to think, oh, well, woe is me. I won't enjoy eternity as much because of that. No, even the joy that parents obtain from their children will be like a shade, a shadow, scarcely two-dimensional compared to the joys of eternity. No one will be in eternity thinking, I would enjoy this eternity so much more if only God had given me children. Or if only God had done this, or if only God had done that. It's quite the opposite. We'll be in eternity grateful for every single choice God made about our lives. There's not a single choice we will see that our Father made on our behalf that we won't thank Him endlessly for. So please keep those things in mind as I talk about God's design of family. So, in the purposes of family. So let's take a look at a first purpose. And it's sort of to scale to a certain extent. I'm sort of starting at one level and one end at another, but it doesn't mean that one is necessarily more important than another, but I want to talk with some of those things that are maybe easiest to grasp at first, at least easiest for me. One divine purpose of family is that the family supports human development and flourishing. That the human family is a great support for our own development and flourishing, and that God designed it to be that way. We see that at the actual creation of family. So when was family created? Let's take a look at that in Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. Now, Genesis 1 tells us that God made man and woman and said, be fruitful and multiply and do all this stuff. But then in chapter 2, we kind of get to zoom in a little bit and we get to see some additional details. And we see, well, how did that happen? What were the details about that? And we see in Genesis 2 that God made Adam, the first man, gave him some instructions, some very important instructions, which he would soon mess up completely. And yet Adam was alone. He did make man and woman immediately. He just made man. And in Genesis 2 and verse 18, we read God saying, sort of to himself, did he say it out loud? I don't really know. But definitely we have the inspired recording that these were his thoughts. In Genesis 2 and verse 18, we read, and the eternal God said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper comparable to him. I've talked about this before. I won't dwell on it a lot. But this is not some, in a sense, spiritually diminished role. The word here, help, well, actually, if you have an old King James, it says help meet for him. That's not actually one word necessarily. We treat help meet in English like it's one word. It's not. He said, I will make a help meet for him. It's not M-E-A-T, regardless of how the world treats the relations between men and women. It means someone who's suitable for him. Like puzzle pieces fitting together, like right and left hand going together. I'll make a helper comparable to him in a way that the giraffes and the salamanders and the chimpanzees so far have not been. I'll make a helper that fits well with him, that is comparable with him. And that is not a diminished capacity. That is one of the ways in which women picture their creator in a special way. If you look up that Hebrew word, just use a simple concordance. You can use Strong's. And grab the word there for help and then find out where it is and find out how many times God himself calls himself a help and shield to Israel. God takes this word he has applied to Eve and applies it to himself. It is a very special way in which our wives help picture their creator. In which women who embrace that role of life to be able to picture their creator. So he did this, and it says, it explains what he did here in let's jump to verse 20. Just skip a verse. It says, 20. So Adam gave names to all the cattle, to the birds of the air, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam, there was not found a helper comparable to him. But actually, that answers my off-the-cuff question earlier. I don't think God said that out loud so Adam could hear him, or this wouldn't make any sense. So Adam saw all these animals, and you do got to wonder. He's seeing a couple of giraffes, you know, maybe a couple of salamanders, a couple of chimpanzees. And thinks, well, I see a couple of this, couple of that. I got nobody, right? You know, maybe he saw one chimpanzee come around the corner and said, oh, man, I hope that's not mine. Oh, good, there's another one. You know, that's right. But he, you know, he felt the lack. You know, I like to believe that was part of God's purpose, not to give everyone names, but actually to help him see that, you know, we all need somebody. Right? We all need somebody. So it says, it continues in verse 21, the eternal God caused a deep sleep to fall on Adam, and he slept, and he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh in its place. Then the rib, which the eternal God had taken from the man, he made into a woman. He brought her to the man. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Unlike all the animals he had seen, this is different. This is someone like me. This is someone like I am. We are the same kind of thing. Then he's noting that. He says she should be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Well, it's easy to say, well, he made man and then he made woman. But he didn't just make woman in that moment. Upon making woman, at that very same instant, God made family. God created family in that very moment. If you haven't seen our DVD, the one that Mr. Jonathan McNair recorded on raising good kids in a bad world, I highly recommend it. It's very good. And in that, if I recall, I don't know, I think it was in the final edited version as well, but one of the points I think he made in that DVD is that sometimes married couples, when they have their first child, they will say, perhaps not thinking, or maybe they've heard it before, they say, oh, we're finally a family. Now we're a family. And the intention is innocent, but it's not correct. No, they became a family when they married. Rather, they are expanding their family. They are growing their family. But Adam and Eve were made a family. That is the definition, verse 24, of the new family unit. You leave father and mother. Your father and mother no longer have parental authority over. They can be advisors. They should be advisors to you. But no, like, you know, if I wanted to tell, let's say, before, I've only got one married son and daughter. But, you know, if I wanted to tell Isabel, hey, here's what you should do. Here's how the cow eats the cabbage. My son has the right to say, no, I will figure out a way to go politely tell my father, go find a beautiful lake, father. And I hope your jump into it is an enjoyable experience for you. But he would have the right to do that to both me and Mr. DeSimone, because he leaves us and cleaves to his wife and makes a new family. And husband and wife are complementary in exactly the way that God describes here. They help each other to flourish. I guarantee you, if you are not married, if you become married, you will change. There will be changes you make in your life. There might be other ways to change. You know, the scripture suggests that Paul was not married, the Apostle Paul. Some have hypothesized different things. I'm not going to go into different, but I think that personally, I think the best evidence suggests that he was not. But you look what Paul went through, you know, shipwrecks. Was it three shipwrecks? All the things he had to go through. And part of me thinks, yeah, if he'd had one wife, he wouldn't have to go through all of that, you know, to kind of shape his character. So that's what it takes to overcome lack of a wife, is shipwrecks. And nah, I'm just kidding. That doesn't take that much. But the fact is, marriage does change you. It shapes you. You can't, living just for yourself suddenly makes you more obviously miserable than it would otherwise. It is a part of human flourishing. It is designed to help us flourish. Now consider children. One of the things about marriage is marriage has a side effect of producing children. One of the tragedies of the world today is couples who don't think they want children. Now, it's one thing to not have children because we can't have children. It's entirely another thing to say, I don't want children, and that's that. And just think they don't want children. That's entirely another thing. It's a rare time in human society that such a sentiment has become so I'd say predominant, but I wouldn't say it's really predominant, so widespread. And you actually have, the New York Times has articles even where you'll talk to people and they kind of thought they never wanted children, never wanted children, never wanted children. And they get to a point where they, sure enough, they didn't have children. They don't have grandchildren and stuff. And they're starting to realize, well, you know, actually, maybe that would have been a good idea. Or you have women that freeze their eggs thinking, well, I don't want children now. I kind of want a career and I want to do this. And so I'm going to freeze my eggs so I can always go back to them, you know, once that change in life comes. And then one lady did, and then none of the eggs worked. And it hit her for the first time. Oh, she had never thought about the possibility that she would never have children. It was always there, and it was a deception. It was a lie. And so now she is feeling regret in that regard. But marriage enables the creation of children, and it does encourage a certain kind of human flourishing. If you think having a spouse changes you, oh man, do children change you, because you will have in your hands this beautiful baby. Honestly, a lot of babies, let's be upfront, they're kind of ugly when they're born, right? You know, their face is all squishy and things. But you won't think that. You will think, oh, what a hideous creature. You'll be excited, right? Christ talks about that, that for all the pain of childbirth, and when you finally have that child there, you're still filled with joy that God has brought a new human into the world and that you were a part of that, and it's beautiful. And what you don't really tend to think about in that moment is what you have in your hand is what you will discover is one of the most selfish entities in all of creation that cares for really nothing but it. That's all it cares about. I'm cold. I'm going to complain. I'm hot. I'm going to complain. I have to go to the bathroom. I'm going to complain. I did go to the bathroom. I'm going to complain. That's what children do. They are not concerned about your schedule. They're not concerned about your hopes and dreams. They are concerned about surviving from one day to another. And sometimes it doesn't even seem that when you look at some of the dumb things they do, because they're children. And they will press us to change. They do contribute to human flourishing in that way. And for them, what an environment it is. Actually, let's turn to Isaiah chapter 49 to see. I'm still talking about our design, our warp and woof. I'm not even trying to get into spiritual concerns at this point. I'm just talking about just plain old natural human flourishing. If you turn to Isaiah chapter 29, we're going to jump into sorry, 49, Isaiah 49. If I said 29 the first time, I apologize. Isaiah 49. And we're going to jump into a statement of prophecy. And I just want to refer to, because I'm not going to talk about the prophecy, but God is trying to communicate to Israel his unchangeable love for them. A love that will never go away no matter how rotten they become. And they were rotten at this point. You can't help but read Isaiah and realize, man, Israel was rotten. They were rotten to God. They're worshiping idols and all these things. And so you see in Isaiah 49, it says here in verse 15. He says to them in verse 15, can a woman forget her nursing child and not have compassion on the son of her womb? Surely they may forget, yet I will not forget you. He's trying to say, look, how unnatural is it to think that somehow a woman who is nursing her children would ever forget them and not care about them? Or the son of her womb, her just thinking, I don't really care about it. No, all of nature tells us that a healthy woman loves her children. Even when they infuriate her, part of why they're infuriating is because she loves them. Otherwise, she could just walk away. She could just leave, but she stays because she loves them and she sacrifices. Christ makes a similar statement in terms of fathers. When he gives his parable, he talks about, you know, if your son asks you for a stone, asks you for bread, are you going to give him a stone? If your son asks for fish, are you going to give him a snake? He says, no, even if you, being evil, know how to be good dads, how much does your heavenly Father know? No, that is our nature, to sacrifice for our children. It's hardwired. We see it literally in the animals that don't even have the benefits of a human spirit that truly mirrors their creator. Not all animals, to be sure, but some of them definitely do. And if you think about that, again, in terms of design for human flourishing, God starts babies off with the best possible environment, with parents that love them and would die for them if they had to. It's a part of human flourishing. Would babies survive if that were not the case? No, they wouldn't. The family's designed for that. But there's an Irish proverb that says, I'm just kidding. I had to do it with the actual. I read it in the Gaelic and I thought I would try to memorize that and forget that. I'm not even going to try. But it says, in the shadow of each other, we live. Or it can be interpreted, in the shelter of each other, we live. Human life is designed to live in community. That is how we were meant to be. God doesn't want us by ourselves, even in the church, off in the living room church of God. That is abhorrent to God's design. It's not the way. He meant us to be in community. And he makes sure that when we're born, we are born in a community with a father and a mother, siblings, grandparents. In his design, every child starts off in the best possible way, in community. And in that, we learn what we need. Family is the intended place for that. Let's look at Ephesians chapter 6. And we'll move on to the next point after this. Ephesians chapter 6. We'll probably mention this verse a little bit later as well. But Ephesians chapter 6, and we'll start right there at the top in verse 1. Ephesians 6 and verse 1. The Apostle Paul admonishes his readers, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with promise, as it reads, that it may be well with you and you may live long on the earth. And you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and admonition of the Lord. You know, I was taught when I got my math degree at Texas A&M, I filled my electives with education classes because it was my goal to be a high school teacher. And in one of those classes, or was in this particular program that I was a part of, I remember the person. I thought she was accurate in this. It made sense and it seemed to fit certain studies, that really used to be in society, they expected there were three pillars that helped to bring all of us up, that helped to make, if you will, citizens of us. And that was the family, the church, and the school. At least in America, it got to be that way. And that, as she was highlighting, and this is the late 80s, early 90s, she said, yeah, we look at our civilization now and the family is faltering and the church doesn't exist for many. And so the school is kind of all our society has it can count on. And wow, that's terrible, right? But I mean, she was talking to teachers trying to say that, look, there's a bigger burden on schools than there have ever been because families aren't doing the job that they used to and churches aren't even a part of lives like they used to be. And so almost the only thing that we have bringing up children in a fullness of way is the schools. And so that helps to explain some of the mentality you see in school systems today, but that's not the way God designed it. He intended the family to be that pillar, that key pillar. In fact, I said this is the last verse in this point. Let's turn to one more, Deuteronomy chapter 6. Likely a very familiar passage, but I want to highlight a specific aspect of it. Deuteronomy chapter 6. And as Moses is going through these things with the people of Israel before they go into the promised land, he says in Deuteronomy chapter 6, way up there in verse 6. Some of you are already there and you feel very smart. Well, congratulations. Good for you. Deuteronomy chapter 6 and verse 6. He says, and these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. Now, there's an implication there that this is how it has to be done. It can't just be, well, kids, it's our once a week Sabbath lesson. Or it can't just be, well, it's 8:30 and time for homeroom and we talk about these things. No one is in a child's life like verse 7 describes other than his or her family. It's not just teaching them diligently. How do you do that? It's when you're sitting in your house, when you're walking by the way, when you're lying down, when you're rising up. It is family that is in the life of a child to accomplish those things. God designed the family to be crucial for human development. And any other alternative, whether it's the schools, whether it's we have a wonderful Sabbath program here for young people. That is fantastic. But it becomes not nearly enough if we as parents take our young people and think, well, I don't really got to talk to them because they have that wonderful instruction after services. That's a formula for making sure our children are not becoming everything that God intended for them to be. So that's one divine purpose of family. The next one, similar, building on the last, but actually expanding a bit. The family teaches us how to interact with the rest of society. It is the family, more than anything else, that teaches us how to interact with the rest of society. You know, there are those out there who worship the family. Sometimes it's more obvious than other things. There's the Quiverful movement where I've known of, I didn't know personally, but I've read the accounts of, for instance. If you never heard of the Quiverful movement, it's one of those that believes you have a virtual obligation before God to have as many children as possible. And that anything you do to obstruct that is wrong and is ungodly and you shouldn't do that. And so you get like the 19 and counting and those kind of TV shows where these people have these massive families. What they don't often talk about is that they're a part of that kind of movement. And there was a woman who was a part of that movement once who found out she had a cancer related to her uterus. And she ended up having emergency surgery. And they're recording how, even as she underwent the procedure, before she went out, she said, I know I'm going to hell for this. Like, she just felt that she was ruining her salvation by somehow doing this. So there are those who worship family perversely. And that's wrong. Nothing can afford to be an idol, right? The first commandment is the first commandment. Jesus Christ literally said, guess what? Yes, you love your husband, you love your wife, you love your father, you love your mother, you love your kids. You need to love me more than that. So we don't want to go in that kind of direction, right? We got to be careful about that. And yet at the same time, so working with that, God didn't intend for families to be these isolated islands that never come into contact with other people. No, families were meant to exist alongside other families, to exist in a society. And it's families that teach us how to interact in that society, to interact with others. You might wonder why I'm going there to begin with, but let's look at 2 Timothy. You might have thought I was going to 1 Timothy 5. Well, haha, I've tricked you. Let's go to 2 Timothy. We'll go there later. But 2 Timothy chapter 3. And I want to read about the last days. To me, 2 Timothy 3 contains one of the most graphic and detailed descriptions of the final age of mankind. And we read it starting in 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 1. 2 Timothy 3 and verse 1. Paul says, "But know this, that in the last days perilous times will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God." Just absolute hedonistic. "Having a form of godliness but denying its power, and from such people turn away." This is a terrible time that is described. Talking about people being brutal to each other, absolutely carnal, traitor, greedy. Terrible things are listed here that characterize the end times. And notice one thing that seems innocent enough that, frankly, if you go, it used to be the Disney Channel would just work whole programs with the theme of this one thing. And so there in verse 2, we went through it pretty quickly. In verse 2, you'll see lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents. It is easy to think, well, you know, kids will be kids. Yeah, we don't say, murderers will be murderers, you know. Murderers got to murder, right? We don't say that. Well, I hope we don't say that. If so, Mr. Strain hopefully is here. You need to talk to him very, very, very quickly. I'd give you permission to just leave and go talk to Mr. Strain. We don't say, you know what? People are just going to be that way. Traitors are going to be traitors, right? It's just the way it is. Disobedient to parents is so terrible that Paul highlights it as a sign of the end times. If we don't think it's that big a deal, it's because we have been culturally conditioned not to realize how absolutely destructive to society that actually is. Now, why is that? Well, we see this answer in 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy chapter 5. 1 Timothy chapter 5. We'll start in verse 1. Paul is trying to instruct Timothy how to behave as a minister with some authority in the congregation. He says in verse 1, "Do not rebuke an older man, but exhort him as a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters with all purity." There's a lot packed into that. He's trying to help Timothy understand how to exist in the miniature society that the church actually is. And what does he point him to? His experiences with family. You know, sometimes sons have to give their dads correction. Now, correction, that's a strong word, you know, but sometimes your dad is actually, or your father-in-law, whatever the case might be, is not quite right. And you might feel you want to say something about it. But how do you say, "Dad, you rotten, you know, dirt bag, you know, no, don't do that." That's what he's saying. He's trying to say, reflect on your father. How would you interact with your father? Try to do that, right? That's kind of the way to go. There needs to be respect for the authority he was in your life. And I will be up front. I've had my kids point mistakes out to me. My terrible, rotten children. You know, they've done that. They've noticed, like, Dad, you know, and they said something. And I appreciate the respect they had when they did so and have benefited from their doing so. Older women as mothers, younger women as sisters. Everyone in our life, those older, our parents, our grandparents, our siblings that are peers, peers we didn't choose. Peers, a lot of us think we never would have, you know, they're assigned to us by God. Keep that in mind. And our younger siblings, we learn about how to deal with those in authority, how to deal when we have authority. We learn how to deal with those who are weaker and those who are stronger. Family teaches all of those things. You see society falling apart? Well, keep in mind, families are falling apart. That's where those kinds of faults tend to start is with the breakdown in the family. In fact, we won't turn there for the sake of time, but reflect back on Ephesians 6. It said, children, respect your parents, right? Honor your parents. But that's actually pulling from a command. It's pulling from a command. It's pulling from the Ten Commandments. And what is the promise that comes with that? He says, honor your parents that your days may be long in the land which the Eternal is giving you. Now that there is certainly a personal aspect to that promise. You are more likely to live longer taking your parents' advice seriously. It's not a guarantee. Many of us know the heartbreak of those who die young. It's not a guarantee, but definitely if you want to hedge your bets, it is. But you know where it did make a difference? This was not just about the individual keeping this. It was also about Israel. You can actually look throughout the Old Testament, especially like in Deuteronomy and Exodus, where he says, do this that your days will be long in the land. And he talks about having just weights and measures. When you're measuring out grain in your store to give someone and you say it's a pound, you make sure that's a pound. That your days may be long in the land that he's giving you. He's not just saying so the guy doesn't say, this guy cheated me on grain and he goes and murders you. He's saying if you want to last long in this land and not get vomited out by the land, then you do these things that will not corrupt a society. That will maintain all the important things a society needs to have. Because you can't let these things go and continue in the land I'm giving you. You'll just be spat out like any of the other pagan nations. That includes things like just weight and measures. The moment you start allowing little hedges, little falsehoods, little things to make sure you maximize your profit, whether it's appropriate or not, you're beginning a downhill fall. It's the same thing with respecting your parents. Children who don't respect their parents don't know how to respect authority in their lives. But again, going back to Ephesians 6, what was the part after the command? He says, and fathers, don't stir your children to wrath in your instruction for them. Do it carefully. Do it mindfully. That also teaches us how to deal with those who are weaker than us. Do we not worry about what they can and can't do? Do we keep pushing them beyond their bounds? Do we give them tasks that they're not actually equipped to be able to accomplish? Working in a family teaches us about how to deal with the rest of society. And often when you see people that don't know how to function in society, you can look at their family circumstances and see they don't know how to function in a family either, for whatever the cause might be. So that is one of the purposes of family, is to teach all of us how to live and function in society. Let's look at a third purpose, a third divine purpose of family. And that is that family is the building block of civilization. Family is the building block of civilization. If you like Legos, family is like that 2x2 brick, right? It's the kind of, you know, you need those. I wouldn't say it's the 1x1 brick, because who wants to build anything in Lego out of just 1x1 bricks, right? You need something a little more than that. But say for the rest of us who are adults and don't always talk about Lego, right? So imagine a house that's built out of bricks. The smallest unit is the family. The smallest unit of civilization. It's actually one of the things that's problematic about modern Western liberalism. I wouldn't even say modern. You go back to some of the philosophers. They see it as the individual. And as a result, they see individual rights as superseding all things. And they see the world, as even modern commentators, they see the world as a competition between those who respect the individual rights versus those that respect the rights of all of society. And as a result, they're faltering between these two extremes, back and forth, not understanding the way God designed it. And the fundamental unit of society is not just the individual, it is the family. That is where things start in society. That is where you have a unit that actually you can build a society with, and you can expand society, and you can grow society. Among the reasons, family is the primary vehicle for the transmission of shared values and culture. Family is the primary vehicle for that. And if you don't have a passing on of values and culture, you do not have a civilization. There's a lot of definitions of civilization. I like this one. I thought this was pretty decent. a society with a shared culture that is continuously passed down through generations. When you talk about the such and such civilization, the Minoan civilization, the Assyrian civilization, that usually meant there was a culture there that you could kind of say, well, the Minoans really liked this and they really valued this and their cities tended to be like this. And what they enjoyed in their leisure time was this. A civilization, it's not that in every detail it has to be that way, but yet there is this kind of sharing of a culture that is passed down. That's often why writing is an essential part of civilization, because writing enables the passing down of culture and values in a very powerful way. And God intends civilizations to be built out of families. If you look at Genesis chapter 18... Now, as we turn to Genesis 18, let me again highlight, that doesn't mean the individuals don't have a role to play. Let me ask you again, presuming the Apostle Paul was not married in the church and did not have children in the church, which again I think is the best interpretation of the evidence, and I haven't seen that we've said otherwise. Did Paul play no role in the culture of the church? No, he was one of the founding members, right? I mean, look at the Bible, how much was written by that man. In fact, how much about marriage was written by that man? How much about child rearing was written by that man? I've heard liberal theologians say, oh man, you just can't read Paul on marriage and children. He had no idea what he's talking about. We might as well cut those things out of the Bible. We don't do that, just so you know. If you think we're going to do that, you're totally in the wrong church. I would recommend you leave right now. Feel free. Crawl if you want so we don't notice you. But anyway, and if you don't think that's true but you're open to it, then hang around. Because we do believe in every bit of the Bible. Okay, so moving on. The family is the building block of civilization. Let's read in Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18. And we'll start in verse 17. This is interesting. This is before God is going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Genesis 18 and verse 17. So he's talking to Abraham, and he kind of says in this aside that we get to hear, in verse 17, he says, the Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Eternal to do righteousness and justice, that the Eternal may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. Now, stop there, because the details are important. You might think, oh yeah, you know, the father, the faithful, etc., all this. Well, God specifically says something here. He says in verse 19, he gives us a reason why he chose to know Abraham. Verse 19, again, for I have known him in order that, for the purpose of, to make sure these things happen, in order that he may command his children and his household after him. That they keep the way of the Eternal, to do righteousness and justice. That the Lord, the Eternal, may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. What has he spoken to him? That he will have a lineage. That his family, his children, children's children, and children's children's children will have a land and be blessed in the land. I did this to create that. The point I'm trying to make about this is God does not think like a modern Western mind. God is a multi-generational thinker. God thinks of lineages. He doesn't just think of the person. He wasn't just thinking of Abraham. He didn't just call Abraham and then decide, well, you know, I've got this guy. Oh, you know what? How about kids? Oh, he's kind of old. Boy, I didn't think about that. I really should have called some younger guy, right? No, from the beginning, that was his plan. Was a multi-generational plan. That's how God thinks. Let's just look at a little bit more evidence about that. There's many things, but I like this one because it sounds so extreme. In Genesis chapter 78. Sorry. Psalm 78. If you have a Genesis chapter 78, please return your Bible for a refund. Psalm 78. Psalm 78. And we'll start in verse 1. Psalm 78 and verse 1. This is a contemplation of Asaph. He says, give ear, Psalm 78, verse 1. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I will utter dark sayings of old, which we have heard and known, and our fathers have told us. There's been a transmission of these things. Our fathers made sure we knew these things. But he continues, verse 4. We will not hide these things from their children, telling to the generation to come the praises of the Eternal and His strength and His wonderful works that He has done. Already talking about those to come, looking ahead. But continue, verse 5. For He established a testimony. A testimony is something to be passed on in Jacob. He appointed a law in Israel, which He commanded our fathers, that they should make them known to their children, that the generation to come might know them, the children who would be born. So he's talking about children who don't even exist yet. This was a part of God's mind, a part of His intention. The children who weren't even born yet, the children who would be born, that what? Those children might arise and declare them to their children. God never is just thinking of us. He's thinking of the children we will produce, and He's thinking of the children that they will produce. God is a multi-generational God. That is His native mindset, if you will. And if we're longing, if we're desiring to have God's own mindset, whether it's our children or not, it's important to think that way. When we see children in our congregation, to recognize they're not an afterthought to God. When the promise there in Acts chapter 2 says that the promise is to you and to your children, He wasn't just saying, and as a bonus, yeah, why not? Throw in the kids, it's worth it. It wasn't just that. He was saying from the beginning, like with Abraham, like it says here in Psalm 78, this is how I think. This can be for you and your children and their children and their children, because that is how God thinks. He builds civilizations out of families. You know, we're not going to turn there, but you might look sometime at Genesis chapter 10. I know some of those passages can seem really boring. They're just a bunch of names. But man, I remember Mr. Weston talking about, why are these kinds of things in the Bible? Why are these lineages in the Bible? In Genesis 10, among the many things it teaches us is that God built the vast peoples of the world out of families. It's often called the Table of Nations, because it shows how God took sometimes just one person, a patriarch, and got him married somehow. Maybe he was a jerk, whatever it was. He somehow found someone willing to marry that patriarch. And then they had children, and they had children, and turned into these vast peoples. That's how God builds civilizations. If you think about it, it's the only way God, the things that God does actually could work. God thinks in terms of lineages. That's how He builds civilizations, is with families. We used to say in the church very commonly, nations, the way God sees them, nations are families grown large. In our civilization, we've kind of cast that aside, and we decide nations are defined by political boundaries and agreements and contracts and treaties. And it's just not the way that God did. Now, how is God going to do things in the millennium? There will be a moving back to that. It's going to take some reset time, but it is interesting. We won't turn there again for the sake of time, but what does He say in Zechariah chapter 14? He doesn't say, if the nation of Egypt does not come up and keep the Feast of Tabernacles. He says, if the family of Egypt does not come up. God is the same yesterday. Well, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. If I'm going to say it, I might as well quote it. Hebrews 13, 8. The way He will think about the millennium is how He thought about the past. Now, just so you know, we are not in charge of recreating the world. So if you are here from Germany, say, I've got German lineage, I don't have to say, well, I was going to say Das Vidania. That's not German. It shows you how I'm going to suffer if I have to go back to Germany, you know, on that side of my family. That's my mother's side. Maybe I could pick my father's side, but I'm not really sure what that is. You know, do I have to go? But no, we're not here to reshape the modern world to match those things. But what are we going to be doing under Jesus Christ? We are going to be helping Him shape the world the way He wants it. And we know how He wants the world. My responsibility is to take my world, which is the small world that I have, and to use that world to illustrate to him, God, this is all I have. This is my whole world. But I want you to know in every choice I make in this, this is how I want to help you shape yours. Please look at what I'm doing. And I hope you see someone that when you do give me the whole world, you see someone who wants to make it the way that you want to make it. So thankfully, it is not our job to reshape all of civilization, but it will be one day. And it'll be important to recognize that God builds civilization out of families. All right, a fourth divine purpose for family is that the family teaches us about our relationship with God. The family teaches us about that relationship. When I say God here, I also do mean the whole family of God, both the Father and the Son. Now, one of my favorite words here is one, I would say it was coined by him, but it wasn't coined by him. You do see it here and there, but not very often, is a word that Mr. Dexter Wakefield used in an article, way back, more than 20 years ago, the March, April 2004 Tomorrow's World article, God is Creating a Family. We actually have it in our only, well, it's not our only now, but our special report. I did turn this message into a telecast, and so when you see that telecast, I'll be offering that particular special report, The Future of the Family. And that article is in that, but you can just, look it up online, not right now, but hopefully after the sermon, you'll think about it. God is creating a family, and there's a word he uses there to push back on a claim about us. Some will claim that we, quote-unquote, anthropomorphize God. Anthropomorphize means man-shaped, that we take the things of man and force them upon our concepts of God. That is, that God is not really a father. Rather, he's analogous to a father, and we're forcing that on him so we can understand him. We're fathers. He's not really, but we're forcing it on him. We're anthropomorphizing him. God is not really a family. We are families, but we're somehow forcing that on God. And that's called anthropomorphizing. However, Mr. Wakefield rightly turns that around to give the biblical perspective. And he says, no, that's not the Bible. We're not anthropomorphizing God. Rather, when God created the universe, he made it a theomorphic universe. That is, creation is theomorphic. That would be God-shaped. God specifically designed the creation to reflect facts about him. So it's not that we are forcing the idea of fatherhood upon a God who is not truly a father. It is rather we are like the analog version of what he is. He is a father, and we are like reflections of that in this life. After 80 billion years in the kingdom of God, when we have been married to Christ, what will we think of as real marriage? Well, I suspect that 80 billion years of marriage to Christ will be what defines actual marriage, not the 50, 60, 70 years, if we're super blessed, that we had on earth with a physical mate. Rather, God designed marriage and the family to reflect eternal things. Therefore, it is not wrong to use those words and phrases and ideas when talking about God, because he designed those things to be that way. And you don't have to, again, take my word for it, or for that matter, Mr. Wakefield's word for it. The Bible shows that to be the case. Just a blatant example before we turn to another passage. Does the Bible say that God made man, and man declared God to be in the image of man? No. Again, what kind of dollar store Bible are you reading out of if that's what it says? By the way, they do have cheap Bibles. I'm not trying to diss that. Rather, it says that he made man in his own image. He literally created something theomorphic in some way. It definitely includes a certain kind of shape if you study that. I have an article about that in an old Living Church News. But also, it's more than that. We're meant to develop the inner image as well. The Apostle Paul talks about that. It's like God gave us the best start, but then gave us the equipment to work with him and allow Christ to live in us so we could even reflect his image on the inner parts as well. It's a theomorphic creation. But let's do turn to a relevant example here in Ephesians chapter 5. Marriage is theomorphic. It was designed to reflect God and in so doing teach us about him. in Ephesians chapter 5. We'll read a few passages. Ephesians 5, verse 22. Starting there, it says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. Husbands, love your wives, just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her." And we can continue in what he's saying here and think, well, is that an analogy? Well, yeah, it's kind of an analogy, but it's so much more profound than that. Analogy is not sufficient to cover these things. Jump down, let's say, to just verse 28. We'll start there, or start again there. Verse 28 says, "So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. For we are members of his body, of his flesh, and of his bones." What did we read earlier in Genesis? That God made woman out of man. And he said, "This is flesh of my flesh and bone of my bone." And here he's saying that is what we are to be, members of his body. Verse 31, "For this reason," quoting Genesis, "a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. This is a great mystery," he says in verse 32, "but I speak concerning Christ and the church." God designed marriage to teach us about that relationship. I've seen messages online on social media from some who used to be amongst us long ago, and how they've rejected these kinds of things and said, "Oh, that's completely terrible. That's not for Christians." There's just the idea that a wife is in submission to husband. That's misogynistic. And you shouldn't do that. That's not the way things are structured. And it breaks my heart because I care about the people saying such things and recognize you depart from the design of God and you suffer. You depart from the design of God and then you fail to learn exactly what he wants you to teach about what it means to be in submission to your husband, Jesus Christ. So your husband can't learn what it means to self-sacrificially love someone like Christ gave up himself utterly and completely for the sake of his church. The family is designed to teach us those things. And just beyond marriage, if you have been a child, then you've had an opportunity to learn what it means in your relationship with God. There's something there to learn. And by the way, I'm pretty sure all of you have been a child. If any of you popped out of a test tube at 25, I really do want to meet you. You know, I would like to meet you. But all of us have started as a child. That has things to teach us. Go back to what we learned where God was talking to Israel and said, "How could I ever forget the children, essentially, that I've nursed? Could a mother forget her nursing child? She will do that before I ever forget you." Christ talking about wanting to protect the people of Jerusalem, that he really was the God of the Old Testament for. Just like a hen wants to protect her own chicks. Even just going back to the most basic ways of life that even animals understand. You know, I could go on. We were reflecting recently about things we lose when our parents die. The ability to ask them questions, you know, the ability to talk with them and I think it was on the podcast actually, talked about how take advantage of those moments. Don't lose the opportunity to get to know your parents. And don't presume you do know them. I thought I knew my parents, and now at 54 I recognize I didn't. There's so much more to them that I did not know. But of the things I remember, you know, my mother's affection. I remember like she would say, "Oh, put your head on my lap," and she would just play with my eyelashes. I know that sounds really weird, right? She just kind of run her finger along my eyelashes. I'm 5 or 6, you know, because you know what? You're going to do weird things with your kid too, right? I remember she used to look for freckles in my hair, right? Yeah, she did a thing. And I think, well, now I can think, well, why did she do that? Well, I know why she did that. She did that for the same reason I ruffle my own kid's hair. Right, for the same reason that I do those kinds of things. The same reason when they were kids, I would count their fingers and toes. It's not because I thought they lost one in the middle of the day, though given the boys, it could happen. But it's because it was a joy to me to do that. It's because, not because my mom just knew that I thought it was cool that she's messing with my eyelashes. It's because she loved it. Because I mattered to her. being a child teaches us that about our Father. Again, going back to what Christ says. He says, if your son asks you for bread, are you going to give him a stone? He goes, you know you won't. You know you won't. He goes, even if you're too poor to get him bread, you're going to feel bad about it and you're going to come as close as you can. That teaches us about our Father. God created family to teach those kinds of lessons. It doesn't mean we can't learn them if we don't have that. Many of us here didn't have the kind of father maybe that we wish we had. Now, my children don't think so, but that's possible, right? Or don't have the kind of mother that we wish we had. It doesn't mean that we can't learn those things. God is capable of teaching us those things, but it does mean it's a little harder for him. It does mean he's got to jump through some hoops he wouldn't have to otherwise. He's committed to it. He will do it if we let him. But the natural place to learn those things as our first classroom is the family. And then finally, in its last purpose, the family points us to our eternal purpose and destiny. The family points us to our eternal purpose and destiny. Let's look at just a couple of passages. First, for cause on this one, as I see, sometimes you feel, I turn to Ephesians chapter 3. Let me get you there before I ramble a bit. Ephesians chapter 3. When you start to see the harlot church sort of gearing up and becoming more popular in the world and more accepted, you actually see the vice president of the United States debating actual Catholic orthodoxy, you know, in the public sphere. It's fascinating. It's fascinating to see the direction that things are going. And so one of the things we're accused of is like, because we'll say things like, hey, guess what? The Trinity, Genesis to Revelation, you're not going to find that word. You're not going to find God described as a Trinity in the Bible. And then sometimes the retort is, well, you say the family of God. You don't see God called a family in the Bible. You don't see all that called a family. Well, one, it's kind of dumb when two of them are called Father and Son. I think that is close enough, right? I think that would be enough, that would suffice. But we actually can say, yes, this is called a family when we see in Ephesians chapter 3 and verse 14. Ephesians 3 and verse 14. For this reason, I bow my knees to the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, from whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named. Yes, my wife is a Smith. My children are Smiths. We even found a girl and stuck her in and called her a Smith too, right? That is the name of my family. And this whole family, because God is a family, is named for him, is named for the Father. And so family points us to this larger reality. Again, it's a theomorphic universe. Our destiny is not these physical families or even these physical circumstances. It is the family beyond. It is the family in eternity that God destines us for. And these paltry physical analogs, if you will, of that family, as beautiful as they are mainly meant to point us to that one. Because that is so much more the fundamental reality. Again, now we are the children of God. Let's turn to the verse that says it. This will be the last one we'll look up. 1 John in chapter 3. 1 John chapter 3. If you read with the understanding we have, you see the picture right here in your face in 1 John chapter 3. We'll start in verse 1. Behold, John writes, what manner of love the Father has bestowed on us that we should be called children of God. If we are focused on the reality that family is meant to point us toward, we understand what this really means, that this is tremendous, that there's no more glorious thing that can be said of you than that you are a child of God. He continues, therefore, the world does not know us because it did not know him. They did not understand him because he fully understood his identity. As you understand your identity as a child of God, they're not going to get you either. Continuing in verse 2, beloved, now we are children of God. Right now, you are a son or daughter of God right now if you have God's Spirit dwelling in you. However, it says it has not yet been revealed what we shall be. You I hope it's not an insult or you don't feel bad, but you don't radiate glory right now. You just don't. In fact, a lot of us, certainly myself, we look kind of goofy, you know? I mean, really, we're not the glorious beings we will be. We are not what we will be. What better picture than a child in the womb? Have you seen what children in the womb look like, right? You know, I mean, it's kind of tadpole-like sometimes, right? It's just like, oh, look, this is an image of what my baby looks like right now. It's like, whoa, what is that? You know, that doesn't look like, well, he's got your eyes. What do you mean, a giant eye patch, honey? Is that what you're saying? No, we develop month by month, week by week, even day by day. We develop more like that until a day comes when the physical baby experiences an analog of what John is talking about right here. Again, back to verse 2. He says, beloved, now we are children of God, just like when you talk to that baby in the womb. Hello, baby. I'm your daddy. You may not like that, but that's the way it is. Now we are children of God. It has not yet been revealed what we shall be, but we know that when he is revealed, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. The very first moment that a child could even conceivably see its destiny is not at all during that 9 months when things are dark and warm and muffled, but the moment they're born. And if they actually could open their eyes and look and see mom and see dad, they'd be seeing their future. Whether they like it or not, they even look like us. You cannot tell me the idea that we are begotten now and that we develop and that we're born at the resurrection is not in the Bible. It's literally playing out right here in 1 John chapter 3. Family is designed by God to point us to a reality, to point us to something beyond this world. When our physical father, who tried his best for all of his faults, will be surpassed by a father, the real father, the one who is perfect. And hopefully we're there with that physical father together in that family. He intends us to learn from this so that we know what's ahead, so we see a picture of the glory to come. To get caught up in just this physical family, forgetting that it points us to an eternal reality, is to miss the entirety of the point. You know, we are promised at some point in Romans chapter 8, it says that the entirety of creation is struggling and it's groaning and it's experiencing utter futility, waiting for one moment. The revealing of the children of God. Literally, the entirety of existence is awaiting for the picture of God's family to no longer just be a picture, but to be complete. That future family is the reason existence exists. And our families are designed to point us to that. Brethren, it is worth the time it takes to fully understand and to embrace the divine purposes of family.